So let's begin with our motivation, everybody. So as we are approaching Thanksgiving and Christmas, it's supposed to be a season for rejoicing and for feeling grateful. So let's see if we can increase those qualities within our own mind. Rejoicing at our own possibilities. Rejoicing also in the virtue of others and the opportunities that others have. It's a wonderful antidote to jealousy. And similarly, feeling grateful for the kindness that others have shown us. Feeling grateful to the Three Jewels for guiding us along the path. Feeling grateful to sentient beings for sustaining our lives. And so with a mind that feels rich, this mind that is grateful, a mind that rejoices, feels quite rich, then let's approach our Dharma study and practice. And with that sense of richness, then it becomes quite easy to generate bodhicitta and aspire for full awakening for the benefit of all beings. And so let's try and do that and then listen to the teachings tonight and share in them as a way of progressing along that path. Noticed how your mind feels so much better when you're rejoicing and when you're feeling grateful? Yeah? I mean, our mind feels happy then, doesn't it? So what's the opposite of feeling grateful?
Being so turned inward that you don't even notice.
Yeah, so very turned inwards that you don't even notice the kindness of others, and feeling sorry for ourselves, and definitely a mind of poverty.
Miserly.
Yeah. Yeah, a mind of lack. I don't have.
Feeling entitled.
You're feeling entitled, right.
Unmet entitlement.
Mm-hmm. And then jealousy was the opposite. I mean, rejoice. I just gave you the answer. It was the opposite. Jealousy. Mm-hmm. Yeah? So that mind of poverty that prevents us from feeling gratitude, the mind of jealousy that interferes with rejoicing, those minds are quite painful, aren't they? Yeah? And yet they rise all the time in us sentient beings. And of course, when they're arisen in our mind, we feel like it's other people's fault. You know, I'm lacking because the world didn't give me something. I'm jealous because it's unfair. Somebody else has something I don't. Yeah, and so that just... you can see that it has nothing to do with the external situation. It's completely our assessment of the external situation. It's how we're describing the external situation to ourselves. Yeah? Because there's just a situation, whatever it is, and we look at it and we say, like when we feel that mind of poverty and we don't feel grateful, we think, well, what do we think? You tell me. Yeah? When you have that mind of poverty, what's the thought in the mind?
There's not enough to go around.
Yeah, what are you saying to yourself?
There's not enough to go around, so I better hold on to what I got.
Okay, there's not enough to go around. I better hold on to what I got. What else?
How come she gets to? How come she has? How come?
How come
not me? How come,
yeah. How come this person has it? How come I don't? How come that person gets to? How come I don't? So that's a mind that is stuck in jealousy. But it's also a mind that jealousy and ingratitude and the mind of poverty are very similar, aren't they? And in the same way that rejoicing and feeling grateful are similar. Yeah, and that they have this richness. What else is going on in your mind when you feel, you know, when there's this feeling of lack? What are you telling yourself?
What is the difference, like, the lack of, I'm not good at nothing. I know it's poverty in some way, but for me, my mind, that's where I go.
You go, I'm not good enough.
I'm a loser.
Yeah. I'm not good enough. I'm a loser. There's nothing for me to feel grateful for because I don't have get anything going for me anyway.
No, I go to the gratefulness. I don't feel like that.
Yeah? Okay. Then you have to think of why you're saying you're a loser. Just a habit, huh?
Well, my mind says every time I do something, it's wrong. So,
of course, we all know that.
But that's what I see. That's what is my experience.
Yeah. Okay. So when there's jealousy, then you know we also feel like I'm incompetent and somebody else is better than I am. Yeah. I'm a loser and somebody else has all these good qualities. Or we feel a different kind of a thought, huh?
The reverse. I think the pride goes both ways. Like, I'm so great, I should have had that experience. Why are they doing it?
Right. Yeah, so it's both ways.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, one is, you know, I'm so great, how come I don't get to have what they have? And the other one is, I'm such a loser, how come I don't get, you know, of course I don't get to have what they have, so I'm jealous. Yeah, I'm jealous for what they have, and the world's unfair. Yeah? Yeah.
I deserve it, and I'm not getting it.
Yeah. Yeah, I deserve it, because I'm me, and I'm not getting it. So I'm entitled to this, and because the world isn't giving it to me, I can retaliate on the world. I can make the world miserable. You know, I'm going to make the world so miserable until it gives me what I want. Yeah, isn't it? Yeah, I mean that's the mind of revenge, isn't it? Yeah, I'm going to harm you until you decide that I was really right all along.
When did that ever work?
It never works. It never works. Yeah. And then that mind of, you know, that feels poverty, there's not enough, I don't have anything to feel grateful for, I had it and then it was taken away from me, or I never got it in the first place. Yeah. And so we get really stuck. Yeah. So then when it comes to Thanksgiving and Christmas, what do we do? Yeah. Yeah, we mope. Yeah. Or forget Thanksgiving and Christmas. I mean, it happens any time of year, doesn't it? Yeah. And it's just, we're coming to that tonight. We're going to be talking a little bit about inattentive awareness. And this is exactly, you know, not inattentive awareness, inappropriate attention. Yeah, inappropriate attention. And that's what it does. It looks at the situation and it creates this story of what I am missing. Okay, so let's keep going here. We started chapter 8 last time. So chapter 8 is showing the methods of fully training the student's mind stream, making it receptive to the development of spiritual paths. Okay, so for chapters 9 through 16, we're going to be going into the correct view of reality. So here is really making the mind fully prepared. So here we're talking specifically about, at least the beginning of the chapter, how it is that afflictions can be abandoned. And so verse 1 was saying, just as friendship between people who disagree doesn't last long, desire does not last long when all things false are recognized. Okay? So if there's two people who disagree, you don't get along and you don't stay together. So in the same way, if you have a mind that, you know, dislikes cyclic existence and sees its faults, then you're not going to hang out in cyclic existence for a long time. Okay? But our problem is that, you know, one day we see the faults in samsara and the next day we think it's great. Or when we see the faults in samsara, which are easy to see, we think that the way of fixing the faults is by getting what we want. We don't think that the way of fixing the faults of samsara is to get out of samsara. Okay? So I was saying it's like, you know, being on the merry-go-round. So, you know, you've been riding the horsey for a while and you're getting a tummy ache and you think it's the horsey's fault. And if you got on the giraffe, that then you wouldn't have a tummy ache anymore. Yeah, you think the solution to your tummy ache is just to get on a giraffe. But you're still going around and going up and down. So your tummy's still going to hurt. But you don't think, gee, I should get off of this merry-go-round altogether. Why don't we think that? Well, we may not know that there's a possibility of getting off. But even if we know, we kind of look and, you know, that little giraffe is kind of cute. I should ride that giraffe for a while. You know, I'll ride the giraffe and then I'll get off. Yeah? And so that's what we do. We seek to tweak our samsara and make it a little bit better and think that's the antidote to our misery. Yeah? And so this is what leads to all kinds of substance abuse and addiction, is when we're seeking a samsaric remedy to a problem that can't be solved by a samsaric remedy.
Yeah. Or we see the fault and then get depressed and paralyzed about it, which is the same thing.
Yeah. Or we see the fault of samsara, okay. But again, we're not seeing that there's an alternative. And because we don't think there's an alternative, then we just say, woe is me, everything's hopeless. Why should I even try? Yeah. So I won't try and get liberated. But I still have enough energy to try and get on the giraffe. Yeah? Or maybe I don't, and I'll just sit here and suck my thumb. Yeah? And how do you suck your thumb when you're an adult? You gamble, you drink, you smoke, you overeat, you overspend, you know, you abuse prescription drugs. Yeah, that's all adult ways of sucking our thumb, isn't it? You know? We get so glued to the internet that, you know, we can't escape. We develop a, you know, I mean, they're talking about addiction to the internet now and addiction to your cell phone and, yeah. So, shopping addiction. Okay. So, verse 177 talks about how afflictions can be abandoned because their focal basis is not definitive. Okay, so we're going to go into a few sections here of really talking why afflictions can be abandoned. So one is that they're the object that they're focused on, and the way we apprehend that object is not something stable. So the verse reads, some are attracted to it, some have aversion to it, some feel confused by it. Thus desire has no object. Okay? So, desire arises for a desirable object, right? But what we see as a desirable object, somebody else sees as something really rather gross and disgusting, and a third person sees as something confusing. Okay? I think spicy food is a very good example of this. Mm-hmm. Okay? Some people love spicy food. Just love it. And spicy food appears, you know, their inappropriate attention, because it's just food. It's just whatever that dish is. But their inappropriate attention says, oh, it's spicy. It's really delicious. This is going to make me happy. So those kind of thoughts in the inappropriate attention are going on. So attachment arises. Yeah. Some of us look at the spicy food and go, oh, it tastes so terrible. You know, I want to get away from that. Don't give me that awful stuff. And develop hatred, because our inappropriate attention is creating a very different story about the spicy food. And then somebody else who walks along, who doesn't know anything about spicy or not spicy, looks at, you know, one person elated and the other person dejected, and goes, huh? You know, I'm confused about this whole thing, you know, should I order it or not order it? Okay, so the object is the same, but based on the story, the interpretation, the inappropriate attention that's going on, then people have three different responses. If the object truly existed, everybody would see it the same way. Okay? If this object were truly existently delicious, everybody, without a doubt, would see that. Yeah? But that's not what happens, is it? If it were truly existent awful, everybody, without a doubt, would see it as awful. But that's not what happens. Okay? So, you know, that shows that something doesn't exist from its own side, you know, as attractive or unattractive, or either as, you know, delicious food or something that you wouldn't even label as food. Yeah, because something that's really spicy, some people wouldn't even call it food, would they?
Poison.
Yeah, they'd call it poison. Yeah. Okay, so the focal objects, you know, the object of the affliction is only imputed by conceptuality and you know, what you're desiring or what you're feeling aversion for or confusion about, again, doesn't exist truly in that way. So therefore, from the point of view of the basis, the object that the affliction is focused on, the afflictions can be eliminated, because if you change the way the inappropriate attention is working, or if you get rid of any kind of inappropriate attention altogether, then that affliction is going to disappear. Yeah? So it's quite interesting, because there's some things that we say, yeah, oh, I really want this. I really need this. As if it's a truly existent need, a truly existent want. Yeah? As if that object, you know, everybody would relate to it in the same way. But not everybody does. Yeah, and another example, a quite interesting one, is somebody might say, I really need a lot of friends. Yeah, I need friends. I want friends. And for another person, having a lot of friends is like, they don't want that. Yeah, they're much happier kind of just being quiet by themselves. Or maybe they like being with animals, not with people. Yeah, so again, here's this kind of thing that, like, when we say, I want friends, that feels like such an inherent part of us, like something I can't give up. Yeah? And yet, for somebody else, they don't feel that strong urge to have a lot of friends. Yeah? And then somebody else has probably never even thought about it. So it's interesting, isn't it? You know, to sometimes look at the things that we feel like we need so much, that either we've been deprived of, or, you know, we've had and now we're lacking. And to see that, gee, not everybody finds that situation wonderful. Yeah? Like, I remember how I told you that about that conference I went to, and that man was, it was as many years ago, and he was giving this talk about how his father didn't take him to the baseball game when he was young, and, you know, here he is, a grown man, and, you know, struck, you know, I'm just so upset, and, you know, this damaged me for so long, because my father didn't take me to the baseball game, and the other boys' fathers took them to the baseball game, and I missed out on this, and da-da-da-da. And, like, the mind so much, like, oh, going to the baseball game with my father is like the most wonderful thing I could have in the world. And my whole childhood is ruined because I didn't have that, you know? And then feeling jealous of all the other boys who had it. But I bet you if you talk to all the other boys who went with their father to the baseball game, some of them were going, oh, I wish I didn't have to do that, you know? Because there's my father, you know, and he would go to the baseball game and drink one beer after another, and I was so embarrassed being with him because his behavior wasn't right, and I just wish I could have stayed home and watched the baseball game on TV instead of having to go with my father. Yeah? And so for somebody else, it's like, totally, you know, like, you want to go to the baseball game with your father? I don't, you know. And you can see how sometimes we get so stuck on, you know, I need something and I've been deprived of it, but then somebody else had that and didn't find that satisfying at all and may have even found it quite awful. Yeah? And so, you know, we can really see from the side of the thing that our mind gets stuck on. There's nothing in it that says, you know, I absolutely, positively need this. You know, that need is coming from our mind. Isn't it? Yeah? It's really coming from our mind.
You could see that clearly in the Nune, where you have this idea that you have to have all these things all day, and then when that practice comes, we don't have all those, and we're just perfectly fine.
Yeah. Yeah, so we did Nune last weekend. And so before doing Nune, did you feel a little bit of apprehension? Yeah, a little bit of apprehension, nervousness. Oh, there's going to be a day, and I can't talk, and I can't eat, and I can't drink anything. What's going to happen to me, and what am I going to do, and can I stand it? And, you know, your mind's like really apprehensive and worried. And then you do the Nune, and it's like, that's not a big deal. Yeah? It's like, okay, you know, once in a while I got a little hungry, once in a while I got thirsty. But it wasn't nearly as big of a thing as our mind made it out to be beforehand. Yeah? So it's another very good example of how things don't exist inherently from their own side. They, you know, depend. I mean, our afflictions in relationship to things depend on our inappropriate attention. Mm-hmm. I was thinking about having a cat. Some people say, oh, I want a cat. You know, I want a pet, then somebody, you know, they cuddle with me when I go to sleep, and they curl in my lap, and a pet always loves me, and, you know, I really want a pet. Yeah. And then somebody else says, oh, God, I grew up with so many pets, and they're barking, and they're meowing, and they're pooping all over the place, and you got to clean up after them, and I want a house with no pets. Yeah? Same thing, isn't it? Yeah. So it's completely dependent on our mind, how we look at it. Okay, so for that reason, afflictions are not stable. You know, they can be changed. So whenever we're in the middle of an affliction, we need to remember, oh, my mind is afflicted right now, and this affliction is impermanent because it doesn't exist inherently in my mind. It can change. Then verse 178 is talking about that another reason that afflictions can be eliminated is that the causes giving rise to the afflictions don't exist truly. Okay? So the verse reads, apart from conceptuality, desire and so forth have no existence. Who with intelligence would hold there are real things imputed by conceptuality? Okay? So afflictions can be abandoned not only because their objects don't truly exist, but also because their causes aren't truly existent. Okay? And so here the cause of afflictions is said to be conceptualizations, you know, and in particular, you know, the inappropriate attention. So afflictions can't be found apart from the conceptualizations of inappropriate attention and imputation by conceptuality. In other words, imputing this as a certain object that has certain qualities and needs, you know, all of that stuff. And then because I've imputed it as that object that has those qualities, then I need to relate to it in a certain way. And, you know. Okay, so it's... So just, you know, afflictions can't be found apart from the conceptualizations of inappropriate attention, or apart from the imputation by conceptuality, giving a name to the object. Just as a snake is imputed to a coiled rope, okay? So their existence, the existence of the afflictions and the existence of the object here is dependent and reliant. It doesn't exist from its own side. So if things did exist from their own side, somebody with intelligence would not hold that they were imputed by conceptuality, because imputed by conceptuality is the opposite of existing from their own side. Okay, so let's look at the rope snake example here. Okay, when a snake is imputed to a rope or to parts of a rope, okay, When a snake is imputed to a rope, the rope, the parts of the rope, when the snake is imputed to a rope, okay, the parts of the rope, aren't the snake. That which possesses the parts isn't a snake. The continuum of the rope isn't a snake. And that which possesses the continuum, in other words, the rope, is not the snake either. So when, you know, you can impute a snake to a rope and really believe that there's a snake there and get very frightened, but there's absolutely nothing there that is a snake in the parts, in what possesses the parts, in the continuum, or in what possesses the continuum. Okay, so similarly, the collection of our aggregates, body, feelings, discrimination, volitional factors, and consciousness. So what makes up the collection of the aggregates, in other words, the individual aggregates, the continuity, the continuum of the collection of the aggregates, or that which possesses the continuum, which is the conventional self. Okay? None of those things is the person. Yeah. But when we think I, we feel like there's a real person there. But the parts aren't the person. What possesses the collection of the parts aren't the person. The continuity of the parts or the continuity of the collection isn't the person. You know, and the conventional person that's merely labeled there isn't a findable person either. Okay? So that's because the person exists dependently. So because of being imputed in dependence on the aggregates, the person doesn't exist from its own side. So this is the same case for all phenomena. So even a beautiful thing that we're attached to, or even the affliction itself, doesn't truly exist. Sometimes we think, like anger, we relate to our anger as if it's something truly existent. All anger is what we label upon conceptual states of mind that have the similarity of arising based on in the inappropriate attention that exaggerates the faults of the object, and that wants to, is repelled and wants to flee or fight the object. So, anger is simply what we label in dependence upon different moments of mind that have some related qualities. But when we think my anger, do we think my anger is something that's just labeled in dependence upon a moment of mind here and a moment of mind there and a moment of mind there and one over here that have that same kind of quality? No. We feel like my anger is there, made of concrete inside me, permanent, an inherent part of who I am, inseparable. Yeah? But it's not, is it? It's not. Yeah? So it can be quite, I think, interesting to look at how we relate to our emotions and how we grasp the afflictions themselves as being truly existent, and how that keeps us trapped in the affliction. Whereas if we saw that the affliction is merely labeled depending on different moments of mind, then there's this kind of... it doesn't feel so concrete anymore, does it? It's like, oh, it's what's labeled in dependence on moments of mind. Well, what am I going to hold on to then as being that? Or, gee, that affliction arises dependent on causes. It's a caused phenomena. Something that's a caused phenomena is not always there. Yeah? At least that particular moment of it isn't always there. That particular moment arises and then it goes away. Yeah? But when we say, I'm an angry person, we don't see our anger as something merely labeled. We don't see our anger as something caused and therefore impermanent. The whole way we relate to our afflictions is really kind of messed up, isn't it? Yeah? And that way of relating to our afflictions makes our mind so tight and unhappy. Yeah? Whereas if we're just like, say, oh, this is just, a label I'm giving to moments of mind that have some common points. Yeah, I'm related to our anger that way. Or our greed, you know, or our attachment, or our anxiety, or whatever it is. This is just some moments of mind that have some similar qualities, that's all. Nothing more than that. Nothing, you know, concrete inside me. Okay? So coming back to the snake and rope example here, there is a difference between labeling snake on a rope and labeling person in dependence upon the aggregates. There's a difference. Because when we label snake on a rope, there is no snake there whatsoever. Because there's no way a rope can function as a snake. Okay? So there the imputing, you know, actually indicates the non-existence of the snake. Yeah? But when we impute person in dependence upon the collection of the aggregates, yeah, that doesn't mean that the person's non-existent. It just means that when you search for what the person is, you use ultimate analysis to find out what the word person is actually referring to, then you can't find anything. So in the case of how a person's labeled, that labeling doesn't indicate non-existence. It indicates no inherent existence. Okay? Because the collection of aggregates, once labeled person, functions as a person. Yeah? Whereas a rope, no matter how much you call it snake, there's no way it can function as a snake. Okay? So for the person, the unfindability doesn't indicate non-existence, but it indicates a lack of true existence. Because when no analysis is made, the person designated to the collection of the aggregates functions and does things. Okay? But that isn't the case when you label snake in dependence on a rope, because even then no analysis is made, there's no way the rope can be a snake. Okay? So all phenomena are imputed by conceptuality, but not everything imputed by conceptuality exists. Yeah? Because just because we impute something, you know, and have a name and a concept for something, it doesn't mean that that thing actually exists. And we see this in our daily interactions with people. Yeah? Sometimes we'll say, so-and-so insulted me. Yeah? And we're giving that label to that exchange, you know, with that person. So-and-so insulted me. But, yeah, when we stop to look at the situation and we ask the other person, it turns out that the other person just said something and the person who felt insulted misunderstood it and took it personally and got all upset about something that didn't even happen. Okay? So we've all done that, haven't we? Yeah, we live with each other. We see each other do it. Yeah, somebody misinterprets what somebody else says or what somebody else's movement is and then gets very upset or offended or angry or whatever it is at something that doesn't exist as that to start with. Yeah, are you getting what I'm saying? So just because we impute that person offended me, that person insulted me, we may hold that thought so strongly in our mind that even other people try and explain to us that we misunderstood, we can't hear anything. Yeah, they call this the refractory period. When we're stuck in an emotion, we cannot take in any new emotion that contradicts what we already think. Our mind is totally closed at that time. That person insulted me, or that person doesn't like me, or I'm lousy and undeserving. You know, we take it as some concrete thing, and no matter what somebody says, how much somebody says, look, you're not perceiving the situation correctly, we can't take anything in. Yeah. Can you think of times in your life when you did that and how miserable you were because of it? Yeah? So not everything imputed exists. Yeah, so that's a very good example. We impute all sorts of things and get all in a tizzy about something that hasn't even happened. Okay. Some other examples of imputing things that don't exist is believing in a creator God. Just because there's a whole lot of people who believe that there's some creator deity, you know, just because people believe that doesn't mean that such a thing exists. Yeah. Why? Because when you use reasoning to examine if it's possible for a permanent creator to exist, you come to see that a permanent creator cannot exist. An independent creator cannot exist, because being permanent or being independent contradicts, you know, you can't be permanent and independent and still create. Yeah, it's contradicted by being able to create, because creation means you change. When you are involved in creating something, you change, and other things change. So they can't be permanent, they can't be independent, they can't exist from their own side. Okay. So just because people believe in such a thing doesn't mean it exists. Okay. We went to war in Iraq because there was the imputation of weapons of mass destruction existing in Iraq. And we fought a war over something that didn't exist. Yeah? So just because something's imputed, and no matter how many other people believe it, doesn't mean it exists. Remember the story of the emperor who had no clothes? Yeah? That's kind of the theme of that story, isn't it? Yeah? You can get a lot of people to believe something, but that doesn't mean that it's true. Yeah? And there's the emperor walking around stark naked, and everybody is going, wow, look at those beautiful clothes the emperor is wearing, because they dare not say what they're seeing with their eyes. And they're talking themselves into believing it. Yeah? Okay, so along this line, 60 stanzas of reasoning. Who's the author of that? Nagarjuna. Okay. There's a verse in it that says, the world is caused by ignorance. The fully awakened one said so. Therefore, why is it not feasible to say the world is conceptuality? Okay. So the statement that afflictions arise through conceptuality indicates two aspects of dependent arising. Okay? One is dependence upon causes, among which is inappropriate attention. And the second is dependence on imputation by term and concept. Okay? So remember when, you know, His Holiness talks about dependent arising, he often says there's two kinds, causal dependence and dependent designation. Okay, so this is what it's getting around to. So the first two lines talk about the causal dependence of the 12 links, because they say the world is caused by ignorance. The fully awakened one said so. So that's talking about how the five polluted aggregates come into existence. Yeah, from ignorance, creating karma, leaving a seed on the causal consciousness, and then after rebirth, craving and craving and clinging, ripening that karma, you know, and then you have the resultant consciousness, and you have the six sense sources, and all, you know, birth and all these things, all the different results. Okay, so. You know, it's very interesting thinking when, you know, all the five aggregates all can be traced back to ignorance. Yeah? The five aggregates that make up a human being can be traced back to ignorance. That sometimes is hard to really understand, because sometimes when we say that, we say, but how can that be? Like, I'm my body, so my body's traced back to my sperm and egg, so how are you going to say that's traced back to ignorance? We don't see, but we're a combination of the aggregates, the body and the mind. Yeah. How does having a polluted body and a polluted mind relate to ignorance? Yeah. Did ignorance create the substance of the body? Not exactly. Yeah. But on the other hand, you can't really say that bodies exist free of ignorance either, because they depend on being labeled. You know, they depend on conceptuality. And it's our ignorant mind that is conceiving them. Okay, and then the last two lines, therefore, why is it not feasible to say the world is conceptuality? That's showing the dependent arising of all phenomena being dependent on terms and concepts. Okay, so the statement that the world is conceptuality includes the causal aspect, causal dependence, in that the conceptuality of inappropriate attention causes the afflictions which give rise to karma, the second link, through which sentient beings and their environment come into existence. Okay? And so also saying that the world is conceptuality also indicates the dependent nature of all phenomena in being, in existing by being merely designated, dependent upon the conceptual consciousness that designates them. Yeah, everything we look around, you know, everything looks like it's out there, objective, completely independent of the mind that gives it a name. Yeah? We see it, like we look at the lamp and we think, oh yes, the lamp is labeled, but it's a lamp already, and we just come and give it the name lamp, because already it's really a lamp. Isn't that how we look at it? We all agree. I mean, everybody who studies language knows that we give things labels. Okay? We all agree everything's labeled. But we feel that there's something in that thing prior to its being labeled that makes it that object. Yeah, so it didn't arise due to causes, and it didn't arise, you know, due to conceptuality, putting things together and conceiving of an object and giving it a name. We see it, and it already is that object, and then we just give it a name because that's what we do. Yeah, but even if we didn't give it a name, it would still be that. Yeah. And then, but then when we think, well, okay, let's say the we didn't give it the name lamp, you know, would it still be a lamp? And we feel, yeah, it would still be a lamp. It still lights things up, and yeah, it would still be a lamp, even if we didn't give it the name lamp. Yeah, I mean, that's how ignorance grasps it to existence. Yeah, even I don't give her the name Venerable Tsultrum, she's still Venerable Tsultrum. Yeah. Yeah. You're not Maitri.
Nope.
You're not Karuna.
Nope, we decided that earlier today.
Yes. Yeah. But we have this feeling, like, even we don't call you Venerable Tsultrum, you still are. Yeah.
So the function is imputed to
the,
or no?
Well, the function exists in relationship to the other objects. Mm-hmm. And the function has to be imputed to in relationship to these objects. Because if you don't have any need for light, even though this thing can make light, you wouldn't call it a lamp, because the definition of a lamp is of something that makes light, but if you don't even have the idea of needing light, then you wouldn't even see it as having that function. You know? Yeah. It's interesting to think that there can be, you know, all sorts, maybe there's things have all sorts of functions that we don't even think of them having, and so we never use them that way.
If you couldn't see, that would be a heater.
Yeah, right. If you were blind, that would be a heater. Mm. Yeah? You wouldn't think of it as a lamp, would you? So, you know, maybe that's how people develop these powers to do supernormal activities. Is there, maybe they're able to see functions in things and conceive of those functions, you know, that we just can't, that we're just totally zoned out about. You know, I wonder sometimes if that has some role in developing, you know, because these yogis with very deep concentration can manipulate the elements. Yeah. You know, like they can walk on water, they can fly in space. But we don't conceive of water as something that you walk on, or space as something that we ourselves could fly in. Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting to think about, isn't it?
This whole thing kind of reminds me a little bit of, like, when you get cut, and you see it, and it's fine, and there's no pain. Mm-hmm. But then your conceptual mind, oh, I'm cut. And then, boom, here comes the pain.
Right, right.
It's very similar
yeah,
to that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like, sometimes when you get cut, mm-hmm. and you look at it, no big deal. Mm-hmm. And then the mind says, oh, but I'm bleeding. And then the pain comes. And you look, and you can see how that works. When you look at little children, mm-hmm. they'll fall down. Then they look at mommy and daddy, to see if they're supposed to cry. You know? They aren't in touch with their own body and what they feel themselves. But they look to mom and dad to know, should I cry? Should this hurt? Yeah? And so they may not even hurt at the beginning, but because mom and dad are really concerned, then it starts to hurt. Yeah? Quite interesting, isn't it? Yeah. And sometimes, I mean, that even happens to us as an adult. We may not be upset about something, and then we talk to a friend who says, really? Somebody said that? Somebody did this? You really need to be upset. How can you tolerate that? And then, of course, we get upset, you know? And then, once we get upset, we believe that, you know, the cause of our upset really exists out there. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Any questions? Yeah.
Venerable, I never quite get, where does inappropriate attention fit within, like within contact and feeling, for example, like, you know, maybe kind of technical, but we have this response, we have this reaction. Where is an appropriate play its role in elaborating in the process of responding and having uh-huh. feeling and then having attachment or
yeah. Well, in the case with the child, uh-huh. okay, the child falls down, there's some feeling that's pleasant or unpleasant mm-hmm. that the child isn't tuned into. When they get the message from mom and dad that this hurts, then inappropriate attention says, this hurts, and the child cries. Yeah?
So it's more like elaborating on the feeling? That the story comes out of that?
It could be that there's a basic feeling, and then the inappropriate attention makes it much more, much bigger than it is. Mm-hmm. Or it could be that there's a basic feeling, and the inappropriate attention tells us we feel the opposite. Yeah, that can happen sometimes too. Yeah? I mean, we can see sometimes somebody says something to one person and that person feels, oh, that was really pleasant. That was very nice what that person said. They have a pleasant feeling from the words because their inappropriate attention interpreted it that way. And then somebody else said, but they were insulting you. And then quickly, you know, they have an unpleasant feeling from those same words, from the same situation. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Samuel John has a question. Mm-hmm. How is the basis of designation also not there without the designation? Is this the same kind of thing as the function depending on things in relation to other things and the imputer?
Okay, the thing is, that something being a basis of designation depends on there being a designated object. Okay? So the collection of parts can exist there, and they can exist in the proper shape, but until the mind comes and puts that together as an object that performs a specific function, those parts don't become a basis of designation. And those parts can't perform the function of the object because it hasn't even been labeled as that object. And without it being labeled in that way, nobody's even going to think of using it in that way. Okay? So it's kind of like, you know, something being a basis of designation depends on there being a designated object that's designated in dependence on that basis. In the same way that something being a cause depends upon there being the possibility of a result coming. You wouldn't call something a cause if there's no possibility of a result. So in that way of dependency, this is called mutual dependence or relational dependence. In the sense, you know, in causal dependence, the result depends upon the cause. In relational dependence, the cause and effect depend upon each other because something can't be a cause without there being the potential of an effect. Something can't be an effect without there being cause to it. Okay? So it's the same when they talk about agent, object, and action. Yeah? Something doesn't become the agent of without there being an action and something that's acted upon. Okay? And you're not going to have an action without somebody who's doing the action and something being acted upon. And you don't have something acted upon without an action and an agent.
And that's an example of mutual dependence, too.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
and
that's all.
There's no sequence in that.
No, there's no sequence. Okay. But we feel like there's a sequence.
Right.
We feel like in the action of giving, you know, first there's me. Okay.
Always.
First there's me. Then some people say the second thing is there's the recipient. And the third thing is, there's the thing I'm giving. And that they happen in that order. Actually, you know, we don't become the giver until there is a recipient and a gift. Yeah? But we see all these things as like being out there by themselves. And what's really strange, when we think about the consciousness, you know, perceiving an object, that the consciousness, you know, as the perceiver, yeah, the consciousness doesn't become a perceiver unless there's an object and a sense organ and an organ of some sort. Whereas we feel like the consciousness is just sitting there, all isolated by itself. The object is out there, isolated by itself. The sense object, like the eye, is out there. It's already an eye. That's already yellow. That's already maroon. And the consciousness is already a consciousness. We feel like they're all there isolated. And then perception is they just kind of bump into each other in some way. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But actually, the consciousness doesn't become a consciousness unless there's an object and a sense power. And the object can't become an object. It's only an object because it's perceived. And to be perceived, it needs the sense power. And the sense power is only a sense power because there's an object and a consciousness that it connects. Yeah? But we see all these things as having their own identity inside them. Before any interaction occurs at all, and before any labeling occurs at all.
Yeah. That's true existence.
Huh?
That's true existence.
Yeah. That's the apprehension of true existence, yep. It's grasping at true existence.
So you could say that they all arise and cease in the same moment.
Coming together, comes and goes. You can't say exactly they arise and cease in the same moment, because the object is the cause of the consciousness in causal dependence, which means the cause has to exist before the effect. But in the sense of things being, you know, mutually dependent, then, you know, in that sense, you don't think about time. It's not just, you know, like none of them exist and you give the label and then all of a sudden they appear.
Right.
Yeah, it's not talking about time so much. It's just talking about, you know, yeah, you're not going to get into analyzing at exactly which moment did this become a cause and that become an effect. You know, you're not analyzing that.
Mm-hmm.
When you were describing how we think things come together, you know, in such a like a mechanical way.
Yeah.
But then when you were describing how it doesn't, I kind of got a flash of how things, this flow. But then my mind always goes, how would you, if you just let that happen, you know what I mean? If you just were with that, then how do you, I don't know how you would relate or move through or be able to do things so much.
So in other words,
well, if we understood conventional reality as it was.
Yeah, if we were really in tune with things dependently existing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then our mind gets afraid, like, well, if everything's really dependent like that, how would I even function?
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's coming because, you know, we're still conceiving, we're still holding on to. There's this real me, and I got to be in control here.
So you just keep letting yourself come back to that and
sitting with it of, you can't find it, no matter how much my mind lurches back into, but it's really real out there without being labeled. to come back to. But if it were really, if it really existed like that, then nothing could interact. You know? I mean, if the object were an object from its own side, and the consciousness of consciousness from its own side, and the sense organ a sense organ from its own side, then they couldn't interact. Because they would all be sitting out there as these nice, isolated, independent entities. And then, you know, and that's how we conceive of them. This is a consciousness, whether or not it has an object or needs an object or anything, it's still a consciousness. And this is a sense organ, whether or not it's performing that function or even could perform. And that's an object, whether or not it's perceived or even has a possibility perceived. We conceive it like that, you know, nice, identifiable things. But then when we ask if something really existed like that, could they function? Yeah. If that were an object of a consciousness without the necessity of any consciousness existing or any sense power existing, such a thing couldn't possibly exist, could it? Yeah. So we keep coming, you know, whenever the mind, like I said, lurches back into reifying, saying, but if it really existed the way I'm conceiving it, could it really function at all?
And that's more important than getting a sense of the fluidity of something.
You know, I don't think it's more or less important, you know. I mean, you feel the fluidity when there's some kind of sense of, wow, this is all interrelated.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. None of these things exist independently. You know, the walls don't exist without their roof and a floor. Yeah. Okay.
So with your suggestion that meditative powers result from seeing different functions for things, and taking that together with the past few centuries of science and technological advance constantly, repurposing the objects of the world, is it more our karma or just the creative concentrated limits of our mind that determine what kinds of functions objects can perform?
Oh, I think I would need that question written down so I could study it a little bit. That was a little bit too fast for me to get what the question really was. Do you think it could be asked in a... Can you synthesize it at all? Or John, can you synthesize it? Put it in two lines or less. Yeah?
In the meantime,
okay.
I was thinking about John Howard reading from Cultivating Compassion by Jeffrey Hopkins, and he was saying that one of the key things, the way we perceive ourselves is often through the body consciousness. We feel ourselves, but for other people, we experience them through the visual consciousness.
Yeah.
Therefore, that just makes you think there are other out there.
Right.
How do we work with that? I don't know, when I sit and I experience that feeling of the form, mm-hmm. Immediately, yeah, this is me.
Okay, yeah, so when you have the feeling of the form, you feel, this is me. What's very interesting is watch at how, first of all, there's the concept, it's me. Below that, there's the concept of this is body. There's a concept of a body being there. Before you even say me, you say body. But what are you actually feeling? Aren't you feeling like pressure, different degrees of pressure? Yeah, when you're just with your body consciousness, how do you know you have an arm? You know, don't you conceive of an arm simply because there's some sense of pressure somewhere? And there's these different senses of pressure or different senses of temperature. Yeah? So there's these other things that are actually what you're feeling. You're not feeling body. You're imputing body independence upon other physical sensations. Like, have you ever had it happen where you don't exactly know where your leg is? Like, you wake up in the morning and you don't really know where your leg is, because somehow the sense consciousness isn't functioning at that moment, and you're not feeling, you know, is the pressure here or is the pressure there? Yeah? And then you say, gee, I don't even know where my leg is. Well, how do you even know you have a leg? It's only by feeling different senses of pressure and temperature and texture and all these different things. Yeah. But then we might say, okay, then body can, you know, be divided into all these different sensations. But they're really true existent. Hard is really hard, and smooth is really smooth. But then again, hard, it gets labeled as hard in relationship to something soft. In relationship to another thing, what we're saying is hard now could be considered soft. What we're saying smooth now is in relation to something else could later become rough, even though it hasn't changed. But it has changed, hasn't it? Okay. Yeah.
John has reformed his question.
Okay.
Scientists take petroleum and label it plastic. And the screen just jumped. And it performs thousands of different functions. What limits our ability to see which functions which objects can perform? Our karma, our creativity, our concentration, our wisdom.
Okay. So you're saying that, for example, science has taken petroleum and formed plastics and different things, and then we create these different objects. And what's the second part of the question?
What limits
or enhances even our ability to know what functions a particular object can perform? And this doesn't matter whether it's something created by human beings or not. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It doesn't really matter whether we create plastics out of petroleum or not. But what limits the function something can perform? Our karma, our conceptuality, our wisdom. Some of it depends on karma. Some of it depends on conceptuality. How we conceive things, I think, can also be related to our karma. How things appear to us even before we conceive them. You know, like, when I lived in Dharamsala, there was one year when I lived in Dharamsala, and I was living in this little mud village, you know. They didn't have any toilets. So everybody would go out, you would walk, you know, 5 minutes away, and everybody would poop in the forest. Okay, just, yeah. And you were able to go back the same day and poop in the same place because all the bugs ate your poop from the previous day. So it was clean when you went back there the next day to poop again. And it made, you know, I was sitting there going, you know, to me when I poop, this is like, it's poop and it's disgusting. And to the flies that eat it, this is food. And it's delicious. And I was thinking, now what makes that difference between the fly and me? Now some of it has to do with the way our physical body is constructed. Because a fly can eat that and get nourished. If I ate it, I wouldn't get nourished. So some has to do with our physical body. Okay. And then on the basis of that, we can see how we label the object. The fly labels it food, and I label it poop. Yeah, and then it functions actually as both. Yeah, it functions as both, depending upon who's doing the labeling. Okay. Okay. Yeah. This will be the last question.
It's just an observation as I was in the workshop today going through some of the old baby food jars that Harold had from 10 years ago. And they're filled with objects. So there was this part of me trying to look at the objects and go through thinking about all the memories I've had of similar shaped objects, what function they could be, and we're trying to remember the label. And then there were other things that I had absolutely no idea what the label was. I couldn't even impute it, but I was thinking about what the possible function of them could be, which might not have been the original function. So I had this little game going on, because he kept so many little things that I had no idea what they, what their function are or what their names are.
Yeah.
So I was trying to go through this. Okay, it looks similar to something I remember that did this.
Yeah. And how somebody can save something and see it as really valuable, and somebody else labels it junk, and it performs the function of junk for one person, and it performs the function of being valuable for the other person.
Happens around here all the time.
Yes, doesn't it? I mean, just like clean and dirty, for what one person... clean, does something and says that's clean, and another person walks by and says that's filthy. Why don't you clean it? Yeah. Okay.
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable, and their virtuous actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Losong's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase. Gurana mandala kam niryatayami. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezi, may you stay until samsara ends. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma, done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially at Shravasti Abbey in the West, plural.